everybody, and welcome to the Internet Storm Center podcast. This is a special presentation of all the speeches that were given by the handlers at SANS 2009. This next presentation is entitled Protecting Your Secret Sauce, Tips and Techniques in Protecting Your Intellectual Property, presented by John Bambanek.
Thank you. Again, my name is John. Talks Protecting Your Secret Sauce, basically tips on protecting your intellectual property. Sorry for the technical delays, but there's a talk also here at 8, so I'm going to have to shave about 10 minutes off my talk. So if I go too fast, throw something at me and I'll try to slow down. Here's my agenda. Basically, going to start, good news, bad news, because I always start my presentations with that. The types of data that need protection, data classification, data labeling, how data gets lost, how to remediate it, and then how to sell it to management, because all the tools in the world don't mean anything if nobody installs them and buys them and you don't get approval to run them. And then close with questions and answers. Being a parent of two young children, all my rhetorical devices now revolve around Elmo and Sesame Street. So this presentation is brought to you by the number of two. Since I'm a cynic, I'll start with the bad news first. We're basically getting our clocks cleaned on data theft, both of NPI, Social Security numbers, bank account information, username, password, and trade secret style information. We have huge problems just figuring out where this data is, much less being able to secure it. If you don't know where it resides, you can't put protection and controls around it. We haven't even settled on some of the terminology used in this area. You hear data loss prevention, data leak protection, extrusion, we're even making up words that nobody accepts, much less actually maturing the field of thought and the technology around it. The good news is there are tools and techniques out there that can help with this problem. A good majority of the data leak incidents you see in the media can be protected or prevented based on already known techniques and tools. And the laws in place, typo, sorry about that, aren't too onerous in terms of regulations yet. And I say yet because I also do work in political policy and political consulting, and anytime something is big enough and voters and taxpayers and citizens get aggravated enough, they'll start calling their congressmen and legislators saying, there needs to be a law to stop this. That's how we get Sarbanes-Oxley, HIPAA, and Gramm-Leach-Bailey breach notification laws and so on. This is sort of a call to action. We need to fix our problem, or Congress or the EU or whatever regulatory body will come in and establish a bunch of compliance to attempt to do it for us. There's two classes of data that need protection. There's basically your organization's secrets, and there's somebody else's secrets. In terms of your secrets, that's not easy to define in a general sense because every organization, every business is different. Publicly traded companies need to protect their financial info, particularly before they disclose it via SEC rules or whatever regulatory bodies overseas happen to regulate that. Restaurants, their books don't matter as much. So it's very tailored to the kind of business and organization that you are, so it has to be customized to that. There's also somebody else's secrets, which basically fall into two categories, whether it's a vendor, stuff that's released under a non-disclosure agreement, and then again, NPI, whether it's medical records, credit card information, bank account information, stuff that you're required to protect by law, in most of the states of the union right now, at least. The reason I separate out the two is because you can't treat the two the same. The risk profiles are different. The kind of people who are after trade secrets are not the same kind of people after, say, a bank, a list of credit card information. Trade secrets, you'll tend to get either a foreign nation or a competitor who's just trying to cut down on their R&D costs by stealing your work. In terms of financially significant data, like credit cards, bank accounts, that tends to be more organized crime. The motives behind those two organizations are different, so the threats and the avenues that they take are also different. Now, data classification is just basically saying, okay, this information product is confidential, or it's trade secret, or it's in the we don't care about category. It's necessary to figure out, when you create an information product, to classify it appropriately when it's created. by and large, if everyone knows that it needs to be protected in advance, it stays protected. Whatever you classify an information product at its beginning tends to carry with it as long until it's eventually destroyed or shredded or otherwise disposed of. If people think it's inconsequential, they're going to treat it inconsequential. They may put it up in their cube, they may throw it in their backpack, take it home from work. If they don't think it matters, they're not going to take the appropriate steps to protect it. Data classification needs to be well known and accepted throughout the organization with policies to support it. If there's ambiguity, if there's debate, your policies and procedures, your data protection mechanisms will not be as effective. If one group says, well, you need to protect this information, but the data owners or data creators, data maintainers says, no, we don't. I don't want to adopt those costs. They simply won't, especially now with a constricting economy. Policy must be the foundation of data protection, because policy is sort of the foundational guidelines and rules for every organization is generally accepted. You know, why do we have to do this? The enterprise policy says so. Discussion ends. I tend to approach things in a philosophical way, starting with policy as the foundation and moving up from there, again, because it's kind of built-in acceptance. Why do we do this? The policy says so. It ends debate and discussion as long as the policy is clear. Now, almost as important as data classification is data labeling. Something could be classified as confidential, but if it's not labeled such or somebody can't figure that out, does it really matter? Kind of the argument, if a tree falls in the forest, doesn't make a sound. If something's confidential, it's not labeled such, is it really confidential? Now, kind of switching gears slightly, there's two views of how to look at data loss. People view it as a business problem or a technical problem. Technical tools can't help business processes, so there's a bunch of critics out there of data loss prevention products saying, these are really business processes, you can give us all these tools, but it's a waste of money, it's really a business problem. In reality, it's a little bit of both, but I'm more on the business side of it, but there are technical aspects and both need to be addressed. Again, it requires a bottom-up approach, you know, starting with your policies, moving up from there. Okay. Basically, as a quick list of what I thought of as the typical loss vectors of this information in terms of how it leaves an organization. There's, of course, external theft, laptops, PDAs, Blackberries, USB drives, printouts. Somebody throws a brick through somebody's car, steals a laptop, what do they get? Malicious software, whether it's keyloggers or something that steals documents, steals certs. Basically, malware we've all come to know and love. Inappropriate software, which is software that's not necessarily malicious, depending on if you think peer-to-peer software is malicious, but there's plenty of software that might have a legitimate use but can lead to data leaving your organization so that you cannot protect it. Of course, there's social engineering, which has been present forever in information security, going back to Kevin Mitnick, network intrusions and web application security vulnerabilities, loss because your vendors have lost information, and then, of course, internal theft or corporate espionage or corporate sabotage. By external theft, you mean kind of confidential information that's stored on something that gets stolen. Usually, that something is outside of your physical building. The biggest case of that involves Veterans Affairs. There's a bunch of data on a laptop. The laptop got lost, so the information is thought to be compromised. It may not, in fact, be compromised, but because the law is structured the way they are, you have to treat it as if it were compromised now. I don't think we've seen any of this in a while. At least it hasn't made news of backup tapes going missing. People shipping their backup tapes to long-term storage, and all of a sudden it gets lost in transit. Traditional dumpster diving, people throw something out in the trash can out and back, and somebody grabs it. PDAs, BlackBerry, smartphone theft, which tends to be more common overseas, but certainly common here because these little devices have street value, so people lift them. But there are people who will target executives or people who are thought to have information and just steal their PDAs to see what they can get. By malware, there's, of course, commodity malware that's used in phishing, social networking, spam, banner malware, where things you go to a wrong site and it's got a banner that infects your machine. Things like KubeFace from Facebook, several others. That's an easier problem. The one I want to highlight here is targeted malware, because it is very easy to develop targeted malware using known or at least lesser known vulnerabilities and know ahead of time if there's going to be antivirus detection. There's a place like VirusTotal, several others. Upload a file, it shows all clean. You know you've got a good piece of targeted malware. And because of the way we detect malware now with antiviruses or honeypots and stuff like that, if you laser target your malware, you escape all of that detection, and it's possible that data starts leaving an organization. An example of that was, I believe last year, maybe it was 18 months ago, about a third of the CEOs in the United States got what looked like a fake subpoena to a U.S. district court in, I believe, the Central District of California. If you open up the email, it looked kind of legit. It had a seal in there. It said, you've been summoned. You send it to a CEO. He sees a summons. He gets all nervous. He clicks on a link, and all of a sudden it infects him. Interestingly enough, this piece of malware also affected some people in the U.S. Attorney's Office in California because it got forwarded on. It was a very effective piece of targeted malware, except the way they did it was kind of, it could have been done a lot better. As an interesting story you can ask me about later, I'm admitted unofficially to the Central District of Illinois as a federal attorney, even though I'm not an attorney. There's a very structured format to how the court communicates to you. This did not follow that at all. So people knew that something was up. But if they would have structured the communication appropriately, it would have easily gotten through and nobody would have known for days until it was too late. Another vector, I'm sure, I don't know, if your organization's anything like mine, there's usually a coffee shop or Panera is common in the Midwest. I don't know how far out it gets. Where there's free wireless, it's very easy to sit there and infect people with malware in one of these wireless hotspots that's right near an organization. Say you're targeting, you know, Bank of America, you sit outside the Starbucks or Panera or whatever outside of Bank of America, you infect wireless computers that come up knowing that you're probably going to get mostly those people. So as an example, like I said, Panera is kind of in the Midwest in my area. You know, this is kind of their free little login page where they say, okay, do you accept our terms and conditions? Well, it wouldn't be that hard to create a page that, I believe this center thinks a little flash animation where you could sit there and put in some hostile JavaScript or something. It's over HTTP, so you can do kind of an AirPwn style man-in-the-middle attack. It would be very easy to sit there and compromise this using off-the-shelf, well-known tools that, you know, perhaps in some of your classes you're even talking about right now. Inappropriate software. Again, there's a subset of software that's not necessarily malicious, but still can lead to data leakage. Peer-to-peer, Google Desktop, third-party file storage like Google Docs, Google Base, Z Drive. Actually, I pulled this presentation. It's stored up on Google Base, for instance. It's a neat little tool if you use it right, but if you put the wrong stuff on there, then it's very easily accessible to others. Some of these liberally share information what's on your client machine. More importantly, if the data is stored on a third-party system, you can't control the security of that information. Once I upload this stuff to Google Base, even if I say I don't want anybody to view it, I'm trusting that Google's information systems are secure. If they get breached, well, my data is compromised too. And they may not even tell me that that breach has occurred. There's only a very narrowly defined set of cases where a breach notification is required. It usually has to deal with NPI or personal information. If you put confidential information up there and you get breached, they may not tell you it's been stolen. As an example, Marine One, which is the president, it's the designation of the helicopter that's transporting the president at any time, but there's a small fleet of these aircraft. The specs and the guidelines and all the documentation for this aircraft were leaked out and shared on a peer-to-peer network that was based in Iran. And what they found was a defense contractor who had these plans had a machine with peer-to-peer on it, Nutella, I believe for sure, and that led to the information getting out there. I think all they really wanted to do, from sort of the unofficial report, they wanted to get a couple songs off the internet and didn't realize Nutella would happily share their entire, you know, hard drive out to the internet and to the world. And some enterprising individual in Tehran said, "That's interesting, Marine1.doc, what's that?" and found the specs for Marine One. As a second example, hackers, and we don't know how they get in, so I don't like throwing that word around too much, stole terabytes of data on the experimental F-35 fighter. And, you know, if you think about that a second, I believe it's about 4 terabytes worth of data that was stolen that left that organization somehow, and they didn't know about it until someone reported to them that the information got lost. So I should give us some pause here, is that, 4 terabytes is no small amount of data, and for that to leave without it ever getting detected is a problem, and it shows where we are as an industry. Social engineering, you know, why are people still doing it? Because it still works. People are getting passwords reset. People are imitating customers, vendors, imitating senior leadership to weasel their way into an organization to find more information, to get things sent to them, or to inject things into a system. LinkedIn and Facebook, however, make this perennial problem that much easier. You can very easily map many organizations by saying, going to LinkedIn, for instance. Okay, I know that, you know, Marcus is with the Internet Storm Center. Let's see who he's connected with. You know, you can say, okay, here's all the handlers. You know, Alan Paller is director of research. And you start mapping these things, and you can use these relationships to do a social engineering attack in a more authentic way. You know the people in the organization. So say, okay, well, he knows who he's talking about, so maybe it's legit. And of course, you know, is that courier the person bringing you a package really a courier, or, you know, somebody who's working with utility, a power individual, phone, water, are they actually with that company? There are plenty of cases where people imitate utilities to come in to get access to your facilities. Intrusions. I would argue there are fewer true network intrusions, and by network intrusions, I mean layer 1 through 4 on the OSI stack. I believe most of the intrusions that are successful, at least at getting information, are layer 7 in terms of application layer, cross-site scripting, SQL injection, those level of web application security vulnerabilities. And of course, there's accidental publishing of confidential information. You know, one of my old employers, the secretary sent out a spreadsheet of here's everybody, you know, in the organization. By the way, here's their social security numbers, here's their birth dates and all this stuff. And, well, you know, oops, that was a big PR nightmare for them. Vendors. Vendors may be given confidential information based on the kind of relationship you may have with them. They may require access to your systems, require a privileged level of access to your systems for support contracts, for support contract purposes. Privacy laws, and by that I mean kind of a subset of breach notification laws, require that organizations contractually bind any vendor they share information with to protect that information at some certain level. That doesn't mean they have to do it. It just means you have to contractually bind them and have some level of assurance that they're in fact doing it. Typically, in this case, payment processors are the most prevalent of this. I believe Alan made mention of Heartland, which is a payment processor, I believe, in the Northwest that dealt mostly with restaurants, if I recall that attack correctly. So, I mean, there's payment processors, but there's a lot of other vendors that you deal with. So you have to know what data you're sending to them. Is it something we care about? Is it something confidential? Is it something we're legally required to protect? And then you have to take steps accordingly. Internal theft, of course, is somebody on the inside who is causing harm to your organization. This one is the hardest to protect against. If you trust the wrong person, there really isn't much technology can do for you. If you give somebody the root password to your home machine, they've got root, they can do anything they want. They may involve positions that are not thought of as highly secure confidential positions. The World Bank breach of 6 months ago, I believe, was primarily done by desktop support. Now, normally people don't think of desktop support as somebody, well, I need a background check, I need security clearance. But in the end, it was just desktop support that breached the entire World Bank. You know, and in this case, they could be interested in theft or corporate espionage. This is one of the categories that can go both ways in terms of what they're looking for. Typically, the people who are interested in theft, they're in it for a quick buck, sell the information, get out. They may stay with your organization. Corporate espionage, as soon as they get their objective, they tend to go on, unless there's some reason for them to stick around. Okay, on to remediation. I know I'm talking really fast. Is there any questions while I translate? Okay. As I said before, it all starts with policy. Without that secure foundation, whatever you implement, whether it's technology, procedural, education, will be flawed. There will be gaps that will inevitably develop where things will fall through. You need to answer the questions. What needs to be protected? Why does it need to be protected? What are the requirements for that protection? And the one question I forgot to put up there is, how long is this data needed? When can it be destroyed and gotten rid of? Do we need to create the information at all? It sounds kind of anti-transparency, but there's some piece of information products your organization simply may have no reason to generate. You know, if you're a restaurant, you shouldn't be generating documents that include credit card numbers of everybody who's bought food there. You have no business need for that information or for that product. Don't create it, because that just adds risk. Now, there's two kind of extremes in terms of policy. You can overclassify data or you can underclassify it. There are organizations that say, we trust our people, it's all the same, they're kind of freewheeling with information. There are other organizations that will say that the cafeteria menu is confidential. In both cases, if somebody sees something as overclassified, they take the policy less seriously. If everything's confidential, nothing's confidential, aside of a national security kind of position. I mean, a normal organization that doesn't deal in that space, if they're making everything confidential, people are going to treat it as a spurious and silly policy. The next step up is doing a risk assessment. In order to sit there and say, okay, we need to spend this much in protecting the data, you need to show what kind of risk there is. How valuable that data is, how much would it cost if we lost it, what are the threats specific to that data? Again, trade secrets and MPI, the threats are different. The threat landscape changes. This assessment should be done, and not frequently, but probably annually. Routine penetration tests, vulnerability scans. Nessus is not enough because, again, I mentioned web application security vulnerabilities. Is it possible to outsource the risks? Again, the most common cases with payment processors. You know, if you're a small company that you want to sell stuff online, you can simply outsource the processing of payments to somebody else and simply not worry about the breach notification laws, handling that confidential information. You can simply push that cost off to somebody else who will happily take it, who is more inclined to protect it and has those skills in-house. Security awareness. Again, if your people don't know it's confidential, they can't protect it, or they won't protect it. If they think it's public or it's trivial information, they might take it home with them, they might share it with their friends, and all of a sudden the data gets out and they didn't know any better. If they don't protect it because they didn't know, you can't fire them, or you can't discipline them, or you can't educate them, or you can't blame them. Maybe firing them is too strong of a word. But in the end, a failure for somebody to know that something's confidential is not on the employee, it's upon the organization that didn't set clear and unambiguous policies and communicate that to staff who handles the information. Data classification, data labeling need to be well known. The knowledge needs to be refreshed because people forget some of the nuances of the law. To give you an example, breach notification laws, name plus social security number, name plus driver's license, name plus health information, name plus bank account information, that's confidential, that's NPI. However, bank account information routing number, that's not NPI as far as the law. However, that's still enough to commit fraud. But for most people, it's a detail that might get lost over time if they're not applying it every single day. Responsibility must be on the data creators and data maintainers. You can put in all the data leak prevention tools all day long, but if people who create confidential documents don't label it and don't classify it, those tools will not be as beneficial to you as they could be. Security doesn't see every information product that's ever created in an organization, nor should they. They should be experts in security, not experts in everything the business does. So those people who create the data and maintain it need to preserve that data classification from cradle to grave. Now, in the last talk, in Alan's talk, I guess Eric Cole was saying this, one of the key areas he found in terms of doing his 20 critical controls is that organizations did not know or have a good handle on what hardware they have. Likewise, organizations tend not to have a good handle on what confidential data they have and where it's stored. If you don't know what you have, you can't protect it. If you don't know where it is, you can't protect it. Security awareness training, of course, needs to sit there and cover on social engineering. Security doesn't vet every communication between every employee and every outsider or any other person. The end users, the end staff or employee of an organization need to know what social engineering is, how to recognize it, and what to do when they see it, namely report it. Of course, that needs to be tailored to the kind of organization you have. If you're running a family-owned business, a restaurant, of course, you don't need to go through all of this. If you're running a big multinational firm that has, Department of Defense projects going on, then everybody needs to know, certainly the people handling the classified information. There needs to be some cultural adaptation to storing data securely. Most people think of, oh, if it's on a printout, I'll throw it in my backpack, don't care. There is a gap between the level of confidential and NPI data organizations have and how that data is treated in terms of culture. Security awareness training should also cover general internet safety at work at home. Most people will take their work home with them. Most organizations have no problem with this. However, if they're at home, their home networks need to be generally safe if they're going to work on confidential information. Personnel. Again, it's a hard problem to deal with somebody who you trust wrongly on the inside who takes advantage of that. Use good hiring practices. Is the person you're interviewing really who they say they are? I've had a couple of interviews now and gotten offers based on phone screens that say, I'm John Vamanek, here's my resume. They've never met me. They've never attempted to verify my identity. I could say, I'm Steve Hull, for instance, do a kind of believable British accent and probably sound horrible at it and say, I'm really good at banks. Give me a job at Bank of America. Would anybody really know that I'm not Steve Hall without looking? Maybe not. I've not found many jobs, even in information security, that will take those steps to verify I am who I really say I am. The individual provides their own references. Are those references legit and not somebody who gave their friend, three of their friends a track phone and say, when somebody calls from this organization, say you're a senior manager at Ernst & Young or some big firm and say you like everything you do. Do you notice behavioral changes suddenly? Is somebody acting off at work? You know, it could be some personal problem at home. It could be they're getting a lot more nervous because they're robbing the company blind and they're looking over their shoulder. Establish a no expectation of privacy policy. The law, more or less as it's written now, or at least case law as it's interpreted, at least in the United States, if you don't establish with your staff that there is no expectation of privacy, or more accurately, that you can exercise the right to monitor them, when you monitor them doing something bad, you can't in turn use that against them. I kind of worded that somewhat awkwardly. If you don't tell people you're going to monitor them, theoretically you can't. That provides a legal barrier to taking action against them if they do something bad. I would take a zero-tolerance approach for exceeding authority, and by authority I mean getting privileged access, whether by social engineering it, by doctoring paperwork. If somebody's trying to weasel in more access and more authority in your organization, that should not and cannot be tolerated, especially if it involves confidential information. External data theft, use full disk encryption wherever possible, encrypted folders and drives for confidential data when it's not. There's lots of tools. GBG can be used to create drives now, TrueCrypt, several others. Keeping confidential data in the building as much as possible, depending on what kind of scope of confidential information you have. Don't let people take it home. Is there a reason a nurse needs to take home, you know, a big stack of medical records to her house to work on? You know, if she's working, could she do it better just as efficiently in the office? Once it leaves the physical confines of the building, you're trusting somebody else to handle the physical security of that, who may or may not, in most cases probably not, is qualified to know. For people who travel overseas, executives, or are people in a position to handle confidential information, use throwaway laptops for them. It's very common that when people go overseas with a laptop, something happens with data's access or some illegitimate access to information. Some countries maintain a right to monitor and examine all data that's on an electronic medium coming into the country. Somebody's traveling, okay, you're going overseas, here's a laptop, it's got office, it's got email, maybe not even email, and your presentation or whatever you minimally need, here you go. When it comes back, wipe it and just forget about it and then use it for the next person. Cold boot attacks. I believe last year Tom Liston and Ed Skotus talked about a cold boot attack where you can, a machine that was in Hibernate, you can boot it up, steal a password while it's still resident memory. To help defend against this, in the BIOS settings, don't allow booting from USB, don't allow booting from CD-ROM or any external media, and lock the BIOS down with a password. Internal data theft. This is where a lot of these DLP tools do come into play and can be beneficial, is seeing where data is moving somewhere it needs to not be moving to or it should not be moving to. There's two general philosophies. There's endpoint-based, there's network-based, or to use IDS parlance, host-based, DLP and network-based DLP. Not all these tools are equal, and it's important to mix and match and know where the gaps are in a tool that you get. Some won't look at printing, some won't look at email, some won't look at USB, Bluetooth, copy paste, screen capture. Always somebody can steal information from your organization. And even then, it will not protect anything. You know, most cell phones come with a digital camera. You can say, hold it up to your monitor, click it off. I think this is 2 megapixels in this, which is pretty high resolution for a camera phone, and steal information, and there's no tools you can provide that will defend against that. Again, using encryption to prevent unauthorized access. I mentioned GBG before. The window up here is Adobe Acrobat, where you can set various security settings. You can allow, printing is not allowed, changing it, editing not allowed. You can't add documents to it, no content copying, no commenting, signing, all that kind of stuff. You can restrict the permissions somebody has to a document you share with them. So you can put it up on a web page and they can't save it. They can't print it. They can screen capture it, but that's about it. Using those settings kind of limit the scope of what somebody can do with the data. And really, in the end, the most you can do security-wise is simply make things much more difficult to an adversary. The more difficult things are, the more easy, the more extreme measures they have to take, the more easy it is to detect them. Utilize port security. If somebody's plugging in a USB device, ask why. But more importantly, perform physical inspections. On this slide, this USB thing is basically a keylogger. You plug it into the back of the keyboard, and it logs, I believe this model will log 2 megabytes. What's the first thing everybody does when they come into work in the morning? They log into the laptop. Well, the first 50 bytes will have a username and a password that's sitting in that device. Cleaning crew can put that on in the morning, come back on, take it off. They've got privileged usernames and passwords. How many people actually look at the back of their computers in their organization to see if something like that's attached? Probably not many. Another example, I don't have a picture of this. They make nice little ATM overlays. You can sit there and plop an ATM keypad on top of an existing one, a reader on top of the existing reader. It looks unless you pay real close attention, it looks and feels like a real ATM. It communicates the same way to the device, but there's a little reader who's reading your PIN and reading your card. Eventually, a attacker comes back, takes your stuff away, and they've got a bunch of ATM card information that you can start duplicating cards and PINs. Again, physical inspection of these devices because, again, at the endpoint, it's the easiest place to steal this information. In terms of malware, malicious malware, and inappropriate software, the more secure data that a user touches, the less privilege they should have to their own machine. If somebody's doing nothing but dealing with credit card information or bank accounts or health records, they should not have the ability to install software on their machine. If they want something, they should request it. Somebody else should put it on there for them. It borders on a separation of duties issue at that point. Avoid single sign-on or the various iterations of single sign-on because, again, it's easier to steal one password. If one password has the keys to the whole kingdom and somebody simply just shoulder surfs it, well, then it's game over. They can walk up to a machine and start stealing based on just looking over somebody's shoulder and getting a password. If they need multiple passwords for different administrative zones in the company, it makes it much more difficult. And many regulations hint towards insisting on having multiple passwords across administrative zones. Again, the standard battery of things, antivirus, anti-malware, personal firewall, web content filtering, all these things that probably most of you do now. Centralizing software management, or at least taking it away from the end users so things can be tracked and things can be controlled, particularly if confidential information is involved. Intrusions, again, defense in depth, we're big on that here. Now, the network perimeter, I guess the perimeter, I sort of redefine it somewhat. The perimeter should be around resources and information, not around a physical piece of hardware. What people are interested in is the information. They're not interested in a Dell PowerEdge server sitting in a rack. That's what they're after, so the defenses need to be built around that information. Control the access avenues to the data. Monitor those avenues. If you're dealing with millions of credit card information, there should be very tightly controlled ways that data goes in, data flows out, and those channels should be monitored. Require separation of duties. Again, best practice. Network access control, wireless network access control. No small amount of people have been burned by simply having, or organizations have been burned by having open wireless access points. People get a foothold in, and then they burrow themselves deeper. And it's a very, I shouldn't say it's a simple problem. It's not a trivial problem, but people having, you know, a wireless access point with no encryption that can be broadcast half a city block, they're just asking for people to get on their network. Data loss detection, again, DLP tools provide some of this. To monitor email, printer usage. Is somebody printing out 5,000 pages on the printer, you know, a day when they used to print 50 in a month? That's a problem that needs following up on. Google Alerts can be your friend. One of the things I do on the side is I look for intellectual property theft for SANs. And one of the easiest ways to do it is Google Alerts and Google searches. You can simply just look at our, you know, in quotes, look for the SANS copyright footer, and I can find all sorts of stuff there on the web. You know, I'm not sure if the Pirate Bay is still up. I think it's down for good now, or I didn't follow what happened with that last week. I used to go on the Pirate Bay, you know, do another search. Is, you know, GX Security Essentials material up on Pirate Bay in the torrent? Finding this stuff sooner and looking for it can help limit the damage in the scope, or at least let you know earlier that you can start taking some mitigating steps to deal with that breach. So again, routine searching of peer-to-peer sites. Know who has access to confidential data, and if they have a routine or if they have a breach, then have an escalated response. How many people here, when somebody gets a routine virus on their work laptop, will do a full forensic search of that machine? One person. Now, if somebody comes in and breaches, you know, they get a Facebook spam, get Coopface, click on it, or something like that, I should say, Coopface wouldn't be a problem, but they handle millions of credit cards a day or a month. something should be done to see, okay, did they actually get access to the data? Did they get close, or is it just some commodity thing where they stole passwords? A more in-depth, not necessarily forensic, but certainly find where the malware is, reverse engineer it, and figure out what exactly happened and what exactly was accessed. Again, breach notification laws more or less require, or I should say they don't require it, they hint very strongly towards that direction. And of course, detecting anomalous behavior. Again, going back to the F-35 incident, 4 terabytes leaving an organization probably ought to have been detected by something. More importantly, you know, got all these tools, techniques, now how to sell it, to adopt it to your organization. Even if you're using open source tools, it still costs time, and to management, time is money. But then again, most organizations will want to use paid tools. Support is one reason. The other reason is they want to have somebody to sue if the tool doesn't work, and they get sued. Money and resources are tight, so there needs to be a value proposition shown. The risk assessment is key to that. If we lose this data, it will cost this organization $100 million. To prevent this, I can spend $50,000. That's a good value proposition. You'll get buy-in to that. Especially now, as in Alan's talk, the era of cyber litigation is heating up. I would say that time is here. If you lose confidential data in somebody's home port, you will get sued. You may win, but you're already in a position of weakness from a litigation perspective. You know, probably if it's made public, you've lost data, people are not going to be happy with you already, and that pre-limits the kind of defenses you can walk into court with. Use regulation and legislation wherever possible. If you can say, well, I want to spend this $50,000. Why? Because the law says so. Well, they've got buy-in. There's no debate there, assuming the law, in fact, does say so. Breach notification laws are very helpful. How many people realize that breach notification laws require affirmative security measures, that you have to do something to be in compliance with that law? Small handful. There's about, I kind of culled that into about 44 different requirements, and I'm still kind of going over the nuances to be sure that that's the right list. But there are certain things you need to be doing. If you get breached and you're not doing it, you're going to have a few dozen state attorneys general and the FTC come down and say, you should have been doing this. At that point, when they come in and enforce you, you're probably going to lose a lawsuit when your customers come in with their lawyers. And again, competitors would love to cut their R&D costs by stealing your info. Depending on your organization, you may have trade secrets that if got lost, you'd simply have to close, and that would be the company. You know, if that's the case, that needs to be known and communicated. Yeah, I already mentioned breach notification laws. I kind of preempted myself a little bit. They're enforced reactively. They're not, no one's going to sit there and come to your organization and say, are you doing this? Okay, you're in compliance. But if you get breached, they come in and they're going to take a look. There's going to be an investigation if you lose a lot of records. TJX, which was, I don't know if it's still the biggest, but it was one of the biggest breaches in history. They had to settle with the FTC, and now they're subject to their annual review. Some quick highlights. Encryption in transit of data in transit and at rest for confidential information, risk assessments, modification of security policies as circumstances warrant, limiting access, the detection of unauthorized access, intrusion prevention. Breach notification laws and the FTC are intentionally squishy. They will not come out and tell you, you need to do this, because every organization is different. Every risk profile that organization faces is different, and the cost-benefit will not be the same from one organization to another. You know, a mom-and-pop restaurant who processes credit cards is not going to be able to spend $5 million a year protecting credit card information that flows to their company. Visa and MasterCard, they can spend that kind of cash and should. When existing laws can't be used, cost-benefit. You know, why data protection? Why should I invest in data protection and not some other thing I can invest in for my organization? Well, I get my dollar's worth. And it's important to realize there is such a thing as overprotection. The regulators understand that, and certainly management does. But for everything that you don't do that you probably ought, or not, everything you don't do that would be recommended by state's attorney generals, FTC's various regulators. You need to do the due diligence to figure out, okay, well, we could do this. It would cost us $10 million, but it would be so nominal benefit the cost benefit's not there. Or there's a technical limitation. You need to go through the due diligence of going through these steps, looking at the risk and saying it doesn't make sense to respond to this one. That way, if you get sued, you can turn around and say, we looked at the problem. This is where it is. It provides a defense. It provides a defense and data point for a legal defense. Be flexible, encourage an iterative approach in terms of hardening your organization's data. If you come in as a fascist, clubbing the table, you're just not going to get the response. It's just great, it's a security guys wanting some more money for whatever. And of course, prioritize the deficiencies accordingly. One last comment. SANS is offering a data leak, or I should say it's not offering yet. It's in process of being written, a data leak prevention course. It should be available around August. You can see that on the courses page under SANS new courses as it gets farther in development. I don't believe it's there now, but it should be at some point in the future. Okay. We've talked about the types of data need protection, data classification, data labeling, how that data gets lost, how to fix some of those loss avenues, and how to sell it to management. Are there any questions? I can do one, no questions. How close was I to 8 o'clock? See, that's no fun. I could just ask myself an easy question.